Does a family-based comprehensive approach to obesity help in kids?
Increasing access for donor hearts for people that need heart transplantation.
Does oseltamivir help keep people out of the hospital when they have the flu?
And comparing two different ways of repairing the mitral valve, one done in the United Kingdom, one done in the United States.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, how about if we turn to the New England Journal of Medicine and this soft toss to you as a cardiologist? Go ahead. What about those donor hearts?
As everybody is aware, there are thousands of individuals who need heart transplantation, not only in the U.S., but around the world. There aren't enough donor hearts. Frequently, they're put on mechanical devices that the outcomes aren't quite as good as having a heart transplantation. Typically, heart transplantation occurs with donors that are determined to be brain dead. There's a separate group of people that didn't have brain death, but actually had circulatory death. What this study looked at was, what is the suitability of these hearts for transplantation? And that is, once a person's experienced circulatory death, within 30 minutes, you're able to harvest the heart. And then at that point, you put it on a perfusion machine that allows blood to flow through it, and you can determine how well it works. Use that for a donor heart and a person needs a heart transplantation. And so that's what these individuals compared. 180 patients that underwent transplantation, half had a donor heart, typically from a person that was brain dead. The other half from individuals that experienced circulatory death. What they looked at is 6 months after the transplantation, what was the percentage of people that were alive and didn't need a retransplantation? The 6 month survival among both groups was about 94%. And importantly, when they had somebody that experienced circulatory death, they were able to use about 90% of those hearts. This expands the available number of hearts to individuals around the country.
Since you brought up that point, one of my first questions is, of course, how much will this contribute to the availability of donor hearts?
Well, Elizabeth, it's hard to know the exact numbers, and this paper didn't specifically say that. What they did determine is by having the capability of using either particular heart, it shortened the time the individuals waited for their heart transplant.
And clearly, this is a time-limited kind of an interval. I will recall for our listeners and for you that we just discussed a study looking at kidneys being maintained on exactly these kinds of devices. I had told you, yep, I've heard about this with regard to lungs. Now we're hearing that with regard to hearts, it's successful. I'd like to hear your speculation on why we seem to be seeing these disparate results with different organs.
Sometimes it's based upon how well the organ deals with what's called ischemia, that is having no blow. Second is how well we're able to reperfuse it. And then how do you measure that? With the heart, it's real easy because it's an organ that pumps. It's more difficult with a lung or a kidney if you put it on a perfusion machine because you don't know if the lung's going to work. You don't know where the kidney's going to work. And in fact, in this particular study, 10% or 11% of the organs that they put on the perfusion machine, they decided weren't suitable for transplantation.
I think I'm going to just foreshadow here that we're going to see a study that's going to attempt to identify what factors there are in these different organs that indicate their viability once they're put into a perfusion machine.
You'd like to be able to assess viability relatively early because you want it on the perfusion machine for as short a time as possible. And for organs that either metabolize or excrete things like the kidneys or liver, it may take longer to figure that out. With the heart, it's pretty quick.
I bet that's why you like hearts, isn't it?
Among other reasons.
Let's turn to JAMA. This is a look at a family-based behavioral treatment for childhood obesity that was implemented in a pediatric primary care setting. We all know, of course, that we're having this onerous problem with obesity, and obesity has its roots in childhood. In this randomized clinical trial undertaken in four U.S. settings, they enrolled 452 kids who were 6 to 12 years of age with overweight or obesity, their parents, and 106 of their siblings. They were assigned to undergo either family-based treatment or usual care for obesity and were followed up for 24 months. Their primary outcome measure was the child's change from baseline to 24 months in the percentage above the median body mass index in the general U.S. population normalized for their age and sex. And secondary outcomes were the changes in this measure for the siblings and the BMI for parents. after following them up, they did find that there was a short-term improvement in, for everybody. Child who had overweight or obesity, for the siblings and for the parents. They were able to demonstrate also that they could implement this in a primary care setting with people who were untrained in this particular intervention previously. So that would be fewer resources needed in order to implement it. However, what's the fly in the ointment? I'm turning to you now.
All right, a couple of flies. One is, as you said, there's a short-term benefit. It looked like at 6 months, they lost about 6% of their weight, but by 24 months, they had regained it back. Although there is some benefit, it's really minimal, and it's really not very durable. Unfortunately, this was still a pretty intensive therapy. It occurred over 26 different sessions, usually weekly, then biweekly, then quarterly, and then semi-annually. I don't think we could actually roll it out. What it does tell us is that we need to have ways that are just as effective, less intensive, and have durability.
And I still am constantly brought back to a notion of prevention, feeling like that's what we need to do with children and with adults. We've talked so many times about the fact that weight gain is a gradual process. And so at everyone's interaction with the healthcare system, this ought to be monitored. And when the trajectory is pointing in a direction where this weight gain above what's reasonable or appropriate for age and sex and all those sorts of parameters, that's when we need to step in and say, hello, guess what? We see that there's a problem emerging. What can we do right now?
Elizabeth, as you know, it oftentimes, quote, runs, quote, in families. Childhood obesity oftentimes follows adult obesity. You can't engage a child in this program if you don't engage the parents. The parents are the one who buy the food, that make the food, that encourage the child, and also emulate what kind of physical activity, what healthy lifestyles in terms of sleep and in terms of activity. I mean, you and I are both agreed upon this. Prevention is better than treatment. Different treatments are available, the behavioral therapy. We know that pharmacologic therapy, we're now doing surgery in kids as well. But if we could prevent it, that's really where we get the most benefit.
Staying in JEMMA then.
I tee this up as two different types of surgery for mitral valves. When you look at the heart valves that are most likely to be diseased or leaky, the mitral valve, the one between the left atrium and left ventricle, is the most frequent valvular heart disease. Now, it can occur because the heart swells and the leaflets just can't touch one another. The leaflets are fine. That's about 2/3 of the time. But about 1/3 of the time, the leaflets are diseased some way. And in the past, we used to replace the whole mitral valve. But what we've determined is actually, if we can fix them, we're better off than if we can repair it. Fixing the valve in the U.S. is typically through an incision right in the middle of the chest to the sternum called a median sternotomy. However, in Europe, they do it through what's called a mini thoracotomy. That is, they use a video-assisted device to make a small incision between the ribs, and they do the mitral valve through there. And allegedly, they do it because they feel like the patient can return to function better. They don't have quite a big incision to recover from with just as good a result. But nobody's ever really tested that in a randomized controlled trial. So that's what this particular study did, is they looked at over about a 4 or 5 year period. They had about 300 individuals that needed to have their mitral valve replaced. And about half of them had it through the usual way we do it in the United States. The other half had it done in the usual day, done in the United Kingdom. And by the way, these are by experienced surgeons. The outcome at 12 weeks was no different. Having the minimal surgical procedure didn't get people on their feet any faster. The results of the surgery were just as good. It's about 95% of the time they were able to repair the valve with very minimal leaking after this.
I have to point out the phraseology that people use in order to delineate their conclusions. And in this case, it says the mini thoracotomy is not superior to sternotomy. We employ other phraseology. We could have said is not inferior to. And I think that the nuance there is actually really pretty important. And I wonder about how that plays out in discussions with patients. If somebody said to me, look, I can do this by this little tiny incision, or I can crack open your chest, there's no question of which one I would choose.
What I would say is it was hypothesized that the smaller incision would mean that the person would recover faster at 12 weeks. And what you can say is it's not superior.
And I'm just going to remind you that it's spoken like a guy, because you're not worried about what you look like in a bikini, but I bet a lot of women would ask that question.
So that's a good point, Elizabeth. So if that's a concern, then someone needs to seek a surgeon who is particularly skilled in that technique.
Finally, then, let us turn to JAMA Internal Medicine. This was taking a look at the antiviral oseltamivir and whether it actually prevented hospitalizations in outpatients who had influenza. I know that you and I recall that market run on oseltamivir or Tamiflu when there were flu strains that were out there that were of particular concern. This study takes a look at its meta-analysis, a number of studies. Does it really help? This study population was comprised of 6,295 individuals in whom 54.7% were prescribed oseltamivir. Of great interest to me, their mean age was only 45.3 years. So this was a young group. They took the oseltamivir and it was not associated with a reduced risk of hospitalization. They also broke out those greater than or equal to 65 years of age, and same thing. Guess what? Didn't really help.
Not only did they look at the people over 65, because that is a high risk age group, they looked at other people that have other comorbidities like depressed immune systems or liver disease or kidney disease. And the Tamiflu did not prevent them from being hospitalized either. What does Tamiflu do then? Well, it decreases the symptoms from about one day, and it does lower the titer a bit. But I was really surprised, because this whole time I thought that Tamiflu would prevent hospitalizations, and particularly in higher risk individuals.
This is a medication that's been out there for so long that's been employed, and now we're looking at it more carefully and saying, oops, don't look like it really helps at all. Maybe we ought to throw this one out. They point out in this paper that many of the trials that have been used to inform much of what we thought was our knowledge base were industry trials.
Yeah. Well, in fact, and some of the industry trials didn't show any benefit. One of the points that they made when they talked about the limitations of the study is because there's such a small percentage of people who get hospitalized, the number of patients you have to analyze is going to be 15 or 20 or 25,000 to show any benefit at all. But then you get into the cost-benefit analysis. I mean, are you going to give 30,000 people Tamiflu to prevent one or two deaths? And what's the cost to society?
Is it going to cause you to toss out the Tamiflu?
I think you tell the individuals, listen, if you start taking Tamiflu, you'll have symptoms for a lesser amount of time, but it's not going to prevent the risk of being hospitalized. And then I think the patient gets involved with whether or not they want to, because there are some side effects from taking Tamiflu, mainly GI side effects.
What this makes me say is, should this stuff even be on the market?
If it's important to the patient to have fewer symptoms and they're willing to risk the increased risk of nausea and vomiting, that's their decision.
On that note then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.